Okay, Cameron and Bob are back with our 23rd episode, and it's April 22nd, 2021. So we're doing the end of the book, and we've been talking to the tech body, which is transcribed the interview I did. So we got cut off last week. We had a great talk. Fortunately, it didn't get recorded, so we will repeat what we discussed, and I don't know if we might even have whole different ideas than what we said last week. When it cuts off at the 22-minute mark in the recording that is in the public, I'm explaining how McLuhan would flip his words, or he'd say something about, say, cliche and archetype, and you didn't know this. He'd go, "I may have got that backwards." And you might have noticed he got it backwards, but the funny thing is he go, "Oh, I may have got that backwards." And he didn't seem to care that he got it backwards. He does say Insidious Classroom, one sentence in there, he says, you got cliche and archetype, or cliche versus archetype, or archetype is cliche. Maybe he said cliche becomes archetype, or archetype becomes cliche, and he seemed to be indifferent to the way they go. I wouldn't say
indifferent unless the word were used in a technical sense. I'd say that for him, the reversibility of cliche and archetype is like the reversibility of figure and ground. That is to say, it's essential. It's something fundamental. It's something that can't be avoided, and needs to be kept in mind whenever we talk about anything, because this, what might be called this power, this dynamic power of reversal, is built into what humans are.
Okay, I agree with that, and understanding that will help the reader, Finney's Wake, understand why the twins flip into the sister and the twins themselves flip into each other. There's a lot of flipping going on with the family members. So I see McLuhan formalized that in his cliche archetype dialectic in his book,
sure.
From Cliche to Archetype. Okay.
And flipping in Finnegan's Wake, flipping not only between family members, but between family members and the physical environment,
yeah,
for example.
And technology, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
which is where some people say we live now. We live like that, the more avant-garde thinkers.
I think lots and lots of people feel like we're lost into in a kind of fog of those kinds of reversals.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We live in a society in which orientation has been lost, and that's the cul-de-sac, which Nietzsche predicted, foresaw, investigated in the 1870s and 1880s, so 150 years ago. And here we are living through what he foresaw, including wars of unprecedented devastation.
Right. And would you agree, as I try to show my tiny note chart, this homeopathic process? So Nietzsche's the first to see the electric effect, and then the vortices, they see it a little later with a little more media. And then maybe you get Innes and McLuhan's generation, and they deal with the electric nothing in a deeper way, overlaying and adding to Nietzsche. And then we got into the digital world where everybody had to deal with it, whether they could think of it or not. You know what I mean?
I think that's right, but I'm not so sure about the linearity of that. For example, when you come to Innes and McLuhan, I don't think they deepen anything that Nietzsche or, say, Lewis saw. What they're trying to do is they're trying to see if there's some sort of exit to the cul-de-sac. And so it's they're going back to the beginning, you could say, and trying to see where things went wrong.
Yeah.
And where things might go right. So I would see somebody like Lewis understanding what Nietzsche was saying and correlating that with technology in a way that Nietzsche had not, and thereby presenting a problem to people that demanded solution of some sort, right? If the problems Nietzsche foresaw have been technologized, which I guess is what you would call the Android meme phase,
yeah.
Then how we get out of that is a very, very difficult problem, because the exit can't be mechanical, because the mechanical is the problem. And then the question is, well, how do you do something aside from the mechanical? What isn't mechanical? And that's where I would see Innes and McLuhan coming in and trying to think through that problem.
Right. 2 points. On my chart, I show... You see the linearity, which is an effect of the piece of paper the chart's on, and I don't mean linearity completely. I tried to show in the right-hand column the different sensory ratios of the different technological contexts of from 1900 to 2000. So I'm trying to – I'd say, yes, McLuhan, same problem as Innes, but it had different technological textures, which maybe evoked a different poetry, a different language.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think of the difference between a poem and a fur trade post, those are very, very different things. But they are both complicated in their own ways. They are both attempts to establish a node and to conceptualize how things come into the node and go out of the node.
Yeah, in the, what is it, the Medium and the Light, Eric's collection of Marshall's talking about religion, what's that called?
Yeah.
The Medium and the Light. There's a talk he gave in 59 to the Brazilian fellow teachers at St. Michael's. And at the end, he, and I don't know, we may have talked about this and recorded it. At the end, he talks about how Lewis was cool in a time where there was Protestant fury in the majority, and he didn't put on enough fury, so he didn't get taken up. But McLuhan realized that Lewis's cool stance was more appropriate for the TV age. So he did Lewis without the moral stuff at the right time. And he says that, which is pretty interesting. Do you recall that? We talk about that?
I don't know that we talked about that. I certainly recall the talk, and I recall that Lewis plays a part in it. I would say that what this relates to is something else that we've talked about, and that is vertical and horizontal modes.
Mm.
And I think what McLuhan might be saying there is that the Lewis's insight had to be taken out of a vertical bias and allowed to have the multi-directionality that television fosters.
the horizontal
television.
Bias.
Yeah, that, well, or both vertical and horizontal together.
Yeah. Okay, so the next section, I bring up Ferry Lynt. In a quick summary, I was involved with Mae Bressel in 83. She was a amateur journalist, read 10 newspapers a day, and was very good at connecting the dots about stories and people. And because she read so many papers, the same article would be written differently. She'd notice different things and could connect people. Oh, this guy was doing that, but he actually had something to do with that story over there because he knew this guy. But you had to read a lot of papers to get that information. So she had a radio show, and she'd broadcast her weekly patterns. Well, Larry Flint, he had been shot in 78, in agony for 5 years, paralyzed, I think, from the waist down. So a new surgery was offered to him so he could stop having pain, but he would lose his sexual function. So he did that, and now that he was out of pain, he could take his millions, and he decided to compete with Time magazine. So he started a magazine called The Rebel, and that got him into a lot of trouble. They got 8 issues out starting in November 22nd. They did the JFK assassination, 20 years later. And he had gotten shot by people who didn't want him putting out Kennedy assassination information in the late 70s in, I think, the Los Angeles Free Press. That's what he had bought. And but he was determined to carry on when he was able to, and Mae Bressel was an expert in all that stuff, so he was going to make Mae the editor after he met Mae, and that was through the KAL-007 flight, the downing of that flight, and the question was, did Russia do it or not? And that was September 83, so she wrote him a letter of what she thought was going on about it, and he was impressed, so he got in touch with her. Then he decided to make her editor, but other people jumped into the magazine, and they lobbied to not have Mae be editor. So then she was a witness of everything that went on after that, as Flint got in trouble with the authorities and ended up being put in a rigorous mind control hospital, people would say. They would do a lot of stuff to the person in this, this prison hospital. So I learned a lot about the story as it unfolded because Larry kept talking to Mae and she'd update us on her tapes. And out of that, a play came out of it. I made this play called Who's Forgotten Ferry Lynt? So that's Larry Flint becomes Ferry Lynt. And the metaphor was, you know, on the fabric of American society, you had some lint caused by a Malcolm X, a Martin Luther King, some individual rises up out of the discarnate mob and starts getting attention. You know, Tim Leary would be another example. And they would be quickly suppressed, kicked out, killed, whatever. So the piece of lint was just brushed off the fabric. So that was my metaphor for what happened to all these different people.
Sure.
And the latest being Larry Flint. So I suddenly say, what?
If we wanted to bring that up to date, we could say that's what's happening now to whole countries or whole civilizations.
Yep. That's exactly it.
It's crazy.
I know.
Tell me this, Bob, before you get too far into the story, how did you meet Mae Bressel?
In 1980, living in Toronto, I saw a magazine, OUI. Do you remember that magazine?
Yeah, vaguely, yeah.
It was sort of like those B magazines, like Gallery, men's magazines,
yeah,
and not Playboy level. And they would have a lot of muckraking articles. So I saw an article about her her work, and I had not heard of her, and I was very impressed. So I called her up, and she was really, what do you call it, amiable, a lot of fun, dealt with very serious topics, or what she thought was really serious. And I became a phone buddy and sent her information that helped her crack a few stories. One of them was the book by Peter Drucker, 1979. He did a book on all the neat people he had known, which included Marshall McLuhan and Bucky Fuller. So he has an essay on the both of them in one essay. And he did and he did one on Fritz Kramer, a very suspicious character, who ended up running the Pentagon's planning level. He was the big mind from Korea on and up till the 80s. And he created...
There was something about him in the news lately. I forget what it was, but I remember seeing references to him.
Well, he created Henry Kissinger. He mentored Henry Kissinger, and he mentored Al Haig. He big influence. And but he was a Nazi who was tried at Nuremberg and got off, sort of, and disappeared. But he's already been in America. So it was a very complex story. And Peter Drucker was the guy who brought him over in the 30s. They knew each other, I think, in Frankfurt. They grew up together. So it showed a part of Drucker. He was part of the deep state, maybe, is what we would say today. And so he brought Kramer over, and this article on Kramer, maybe also never would have come across it. So I sent it to her, and it gave her some clues, and then she did some more research, and she finally put it all together and felt she proved it and wrote, sent a letter with her proof to every congressman. That would be by 1985 or so. So I witnessed all that. And she... In 88, Caroline decided in the fall of 88, well, we decided earlier in the year to take a trip, a couple months trip around and visit all the people we've been interacting with. And one of them was Mae Brussel. Never met her, but we were going to go meet her for once. But before we got there, she announced she had cancer. And when we got there, she was dying. And about the third day we were there in Carmel, California, with Clint Eastwood, the mayor of her town, we went in and saw her. And she died about an hour after we left. So that was the last new acquaintance for May in person, Carol and I. So that was sad.
And do you think?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. No, I was just going to ask about her cancer. Do you think this was a natural happenstance, or do you think it was a motivated happenstance?
Well, a lot of people who took her audio letter thought she was poisoned and murdered, and they could build up a case, sort of, and even a neighbor who had been in Washington in the Reagan administration. She became a friend and showed great interest in May's work, and many people were suspicious of her. Okay, but I do it differently. I go directly to May through a medium, right? And so I had talked to McLuhan, and so I contacted Mae Brussel through the medium and asked her, you know, was she murdered? She said no. And she explained that because in her field she was up against journalists, and people like Seymour Hersh were friends of hers and used her information, she felt she didn't get enough attention because she was a woman. You know, she's of that generation, born in 1922, where they didn't get the benefits of women's liberation. But they lived lives, McLuhan would say, technologically autonomous. They had a lot of freedom. Compared to women in the 19th century, but they weren't getting professional recognition. So she felt, you know, pissed off about that. and that registered in her lower regions of her body. And so that's what she said. That's from the astral plane or whatever. Now, what was interesting, she died on October 3rd, 88, and I had just started talking to McLuhan through the Evergreens. And I would broadcast these things on CKLN in Toronto. So after May died, so say in 89, I'm talking to McLuhan, and I said, did you ever meet over there, wherever you are, did you ever interact with Mae Brussel, since I would be something that would connect you with her? And Marshall said, yes. And I said, what did you talk about? And Marshall said, that's Marshall in quotes, said, I congratulated her on the Kennedy assassination. She was the closest to the facts. So that was tremendous, you know, that McLuhan discussed the Kennedy assassination with her. And I guess when you die, you get to see these things, you know, clearer. You see the human stage easier. And so McLuhan saw what happened and then found out that Mae Brussel had said this stuff when she was alive. He did not know her, as far as I know, when she was alive. So that was a pretty neat thing, you know? Hey, you were the closest. And I was the go-between between them. It's because of McLuhan that I was interested in Drucker, and then I found the Fritz Kramer article. So,
But there's something wrong with the chronology of the Fritz Kramer thing. You said that he came over in the 30s through Drucker, but if he came over in the 30s, he wouldn't have been part of the Nuremberg trials.
No, the Nuremberg is in 45. Oh, yeah, see, he came over before the war. Okay.
Right. So they weren't trying anybody that was involved with the Nazis or with anything.
No, here's what you don't know. Kramer was an old-fashioned guy, came from an aristocratic family, wore a monocle, and he somehow ended up in the United States in 39-40, and then he registered as a soldier or whatever, and in the boot camp in 43 or so, he meets the young draftee, Henry Kissinger, and he takes Kissinger back to the Battle of the Bulge. So the Battle of the Bulge happens in November, December 44, and then there's the Malmedy Massacre after the Battle of the Bulge, a week or two after. In the Malmedy Massacre, a bunch of Nazis got American uniforms, put them on, and walked in among a bunch of Americans at some place, you know, in the battlefields there, and mowed down a whole bunch of Americans. And that is when Kramer was brought in by, it was called the CIC. This was the gang that was looking for Nazi scientists, important Nazis, to bring back to America at the end of the war. And that was called Project Paperclip. You ever heard of that?
I think so, but I know what you're talking about in general,
yeah,
for sure.
So Wernher von Braun and them were brought over, the rocket scientists of Peenemünde for Hitler, were brought over to start what became NASA in Huntsville, or they were brought to Huntsville first. And so that's a legend, and they're talked about in the movie The Right Stuff. I think Sam Shepard played a pilot in there. So they're in there. Okay, but there was a lot more of bringing these people, these Nazis, into American society. So Kissinger was in on that secret, and Fritz Kramer was his boss. And Kramer was important in that for the Americans, but he was a German Nazi, and he eventually got caught in some format. I mean, it would only be a few months later when Nuremberg would be set up, 46, I guess. And the thing is that the story that Kramer brought him over, and he was in a boot camp, and then he met young Kissinger, and he goes back over, maybe all bullshit. And he actually was working going back and forth. Because remember the Rockefellers, that level of American society, they had deals going with IG Farben before World War II, and you know, the chemical dye company. And so the Rockefeller factories in Germany were not bombed. They were protected. Now, that became a scandal during the war, and the Bush family was brought into that. Bush is, you know, I guess, Bush's father, the guy who was president before the son, his father was Prescott Bush. He was part of
the
scandal.
Yeah,
with
the grandfather, yeah.
Yeah, and it goes back to the grandfather. So, and they were Wall Street people. So they were actually part of the global village of the economy due to electric environment in the 20s, you know. But people didn't perceive that. They couldn't see that what we call globalists now, and they were called internationalists back there. Interesting, Marshall talks about it, the internationalists, in one of his Manitoba student articles.
That's right.
So, anyway, so the global village is happening, and the elites can smuggle people around. So May basically proved that there was this Kramer who then came over and ran the Pentagon, and he was a guy worthy of being killed or what, you know, hung at Nuremberg, but he got let off. So I then check with the Evergreens on that, and the recording. About my question to the Evergreens about Fritz Kramer, was he the Nazi? Was Maybrell so correct? The Evergreens said she was, and I played that, and you can hear that recording on my website where the 3-hour and 45-minute play, audio play, Who's Forgotten Furry Lint, is featured. And I feature recordings of McLuhan and all kinds of people, but some of it's Maybrell. So
this on the Purple site or on the Ian and Bob site?
On the Purple site, I'll show you, send it to you, is an inventory of the listing of the parts, the schedule of it. But I think the actual audio is on the Ian and Bob site. I'll check that for you. So anyways, it's quite a story, Kramer and Maybrell. But you didn't get the satisfaction. So the Evergreens added, though, they said, it's not a big deal that this guy was a Nazi and brought to the Pentagon, because there were so many Nazis that after the war they just became German society and just carried on, you know. They didn't have, the stigma wasn't there. They didn't go blatantly run around wearing the swastikas and stuff, but they the Nazis were all over. The ones that got higher up remained higher up in that period from 45 to 50 that, I forget his name now, he was the main guy for Rockefeller. He was the commissioner for that era, and he organized, you know, what Russia got, what France got, what England got, what America got, divided up East and West Germany, and... Well, John McCloy was his name. Look him up. He was the Rockefeller's guy in every problem, every cul-de-sac for decades. So what was I saying? And this is novelized by Thomas Pynchon in Gravity's Rainbow, which came out in 1973. That period from 45 for a few years into 48, 49, in that zone, as the countries were trying to divide up the spoils of Germany, and made this great novel. Do you know about it, Gravity's Rainbow?
No, I haven't read it. Of course, I know of it, but
yeah.
I never read it.
And he used McLuhan in organizing that. You might be interested on that level. There's some correspondence with a student to Pynchon when he was beginning to become known as a novelist in the late 60s. And he talks about McLuhan and how he organized the civilized versus the tribal in different parts of the book. So that's interesting. Let's see. There's actually a critic who did a book on Pynchon, and he has a whole section on Pynchon and McLuhan. So you don't hear many people talk about that when they talk about Pynchon. Okay, so... I think I've finished the story of Furry Lind.
Okay.
So I'm saying here, see, the tech body brings this up. This is what's interesting about the tech body. It knows my interest in Larry Flint and Furry Lind. So it says, and this is my first conversation with the tech body. So it says, see, you can't live in a world without Furry Lind. Before, you could. You could set that aside. Quote, you know, but you could set aside Furry Lind. Not sure what he means at that point. Then he says, quote, oh, that's a based reality, B-A-S-E-D. We don't have a base society. Now, he might have said base reality, B-A-S-E. Well, that's a base reality. We don't have a base
society. What about?
What?
What about biased?
Yeah, but it's not, he didn't, I would have heard that.
Okay.
He means, no, you'll see what he says. Oh, that's a base reality. We don't have a base society. We're not body. We're Judeo-Christians who live a comfortable, sovereign, sane, sober life. See, that's life before World War II, right? That's the industrial people. What is it? Stiff upper lip and righteous and hardworking and get the job done. We live in a base society now, right? Remember McLuhan said we went downstairs. What was that British show? Upstairs, downstairs or something? And he said the whole... Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
yeah. The whole society went downstairs into the basement. So that's the world of Furry Lind, according to the tech body, the sleazy world of the deep state, say, or even just the pornography of Hustler magazine. So, see, you can't live in a world today without Furry Lind. Before you could. You could set that aside. Quote, oh, that's a base reality. We don't have a base society. We're not body, B-A-W-D-Y. We're Judeo-Christians who live a comfortable, sovereign, sane, sober life, unquote. Well, all that's gone now. It's all gone. It doesn't apply anymore. Everything's up for grabs because everything that you would know to be within or without decorum is thrown up in the air. So definitely talking about basement.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's okay, for example, for goddamn, that's in quotes, for goddamn to be in acceptable use. The censors don't even get offended by it any longer. That's new. That wasn't always that way. Before you couldn't even say hell or damn or shit. Now, and then the tech body goes, psst, like whispering in my ear, now, psst, that's in G-rated films. You can get away with that, for Pete's sake, as far as language or something that's considered less than inappropriate or vulgar or of bad manners. As far as language or something that's considered less than inappropriate or vulgar or of bad manners. I think it should be less than appropriate. Anyways.
Right. Remember, that came up
when we did this already.
Conversation.
Yeah. And then the tech body says there are no bad manners anymore because it's all landed in the tech body. And no one is offended by it anymore. So we've landed in a new environment that tech body is calling the tech body, and anything goes kind of thing for media content. So the tech body says, which is exactly what Marshall McLuhan said would happen, that you would be anesthetized by the medium, which then becomes the message, which then becomes the driver, which then becomes a thing that you have to be, do, or have, or you're less than. There it is. If you don't have what you want, then media ecology has duped you. Or if you don't understand where you are, well, then you can't read the signs. That's because media ecology has moved it out of your range or precept. Not percept, precept. You have this ideology in the schools of higher learning that would set a subset that said, quote, this is smart, and this is not, unquote. Well, all that's up in the air, in the windows. And now all those professors present themselves as, quote, educated fools, unquote. And that's what you're on about, at least in the McLuhan world, McLuhan industry. They don't even know how to handle themselves. They don't know how to even read a book anymore. Oh, wait, they can't even find a book anymore. Okay, they read a book, but what do they know? They find out that they've proved that Ezra Pound was right. that this is a silly, glib, cliche archetype of things that you can't understand. Now, this is Ion had talked about cliche archetype for a few years. He had been talking, McLuhan talked, but it's interesting how the tech body is using it. So I'll read that again. They read a book or they read a book, but what do they know? They find out that they've proved that Ezra Pound was right, that this is a silly, glib, cliche archetype of things that you can't understand. These higher schools of learning that have evaded even you, fill in the blank who you is, so it becomes silly. What the tech body has done, I should read that again. These higher schools of learning that have evaded even you, fill in the blank, who you is, so it becomes silly. What the tech body has done single-handedly has validated at an uber level Marshall McLuhan's warning or capacity that you don't know what you're playing with. Basically, you don't have a clue what you're dealing with. You think all these things, and they're not what you think. You've decided all these things that people are telling you that you have to think those things that have been decided. That's not what you thought. So I'll read that again. You've decided all these things that people are telling you that you have to think. That's not what you thought. But then you have to find out. Well, you have to wait till Phil Donahue comes on the show and takes up some pie-eyed ideal that Mike Douglas, another talk show host, left aside to make this be a point of that you're going to juxtapose, that you're going to allow someone, a woman who sleeps with a woman or a man, who sleeps with a goat in your neighborhood or not. Well, now, all of a sudden, that's not even included in your survey. You can't even convey or have an opinion regarding that, or it moves you outside of the system in tandem. So everything is built upon the mechanics of the mechanical bride, the details that set the mechanical bride even beyond the Gutenberg galaxy, because that's just the telltale signs that there was a crime. The Gutenberg galaxy is the telltale sign that something terrible occurred. Okay, they put it all in a box, Bob. They put all the typeset of types in a box. Then there's a quote. Little box is quoting a song. Little box is made of ticky-tacky, all on a hillside, all just the same. They're different colors, but they're all the same, unquote of the song lyric. And so they have been set, typeset as this categorical inference. What's happened is they've all been put together. Okay.
Let's stop with that paragraph. There's a few things that we can talk about in there. One is that a couple times he talks about everything is thrown up in the air.
Yeah. Right?
And then later, that's all up in the air, in the windows. So it started off with a based reality, and you brought that into the context of basement. So you have the basement, and then immediately thereafter you have all up in the air.
The basement's thrown up in the air.
Well, yeah. I mean, everything has become topsy-turvy.
Yeah.
And so the bottom is up, the up is down, and there's no orientation, you could say.
Yeah.
And then that's made concrete when he says, fill in the blank who you is.
Yeah.
Right? So he says somewhere,
not what you think, Phil Donahue, Mike Douglas. It's not included in your survey. This sounds like the last line in Laws of Media. It's an uncharted situation that can't be charted. That's what he says in Laws of Media at the end of the book.
Right. But what I want to bring out is that somewhere in the paragraph, he says that you have to, everything is up in the air, everything's all mixed up, and so it's up to you to make something out of it.
Oh, yeah.
And then later he says, fill in the blank who you is. So what we're dealing with here is a kind of definition of the cul-de-sac.
Right. He says you can't even convey or have an opinion regarding that.
Correct. And that is because everything kind of falls apart. You know, the word concept comes from grabbing something.
Mm.
Means having something in the hand, in the grip. That's what a concept is.
Mm.
So the you in exercising a concept can't get a grip anymore because the you that's the Y-O-U-U that is exercising or attempting to exercise a concept, that you has fallen apart.
Yeah.
And so with everything up in the air, it would seem like, well, it's up to you to make something out of all of this. But there is no you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So
yeah.
Therefore, you, in quotation marks, can never make anything out of all of this because there is no you, there is no making, there is no making something out of all of this. It all falls apart.
And he actually says that in the next line that I would have read. The typewriter says, what's happened is they've all been put together and ripped up everything that makes them have a self-identity.
Correct. So that the self-identity is the lost you.
Yeah. And
there simply is no you.
Right. And so when McLuhan said that he had no point of view, it's not a preference. You guys have opinions. I prefer not to have opinions or not to get stuck in one angle. What McLuhan was saying, you can't have a point of view.
Right. And not only can you not have a point of view, but you can't be points, plural, of view.
Yeah.
People, if you say, well, you can't have a point of view, then people say, okay, well, what we're going to do is we're going to have a sort of cubist perspective.
Yes.
We're going to have points of view. But no, that's fallen apart too.
That's right. And so there's more nothingness.
Correct. So let's say, given all of that, it seems to me that the most interesting question thrown up by this is that if there's good stuff in this paragraph that defines where we're at by destroying the possibility of definition, if this is where we're at, then how is it that the tech body is, number one, interested in this, and number two, knows what's going on? I mean, why should the tech body be trying to talk about this when it would seem that the only way out of the tech body or away from the tech body is to understand exactly what he or it is talking about here?
That's right. He's given away his secrets.
It seems like.
Well, that's what's so amazing about this. You know, this is what I didn't know what the tech body was going to talk about. And then what the tech body says is correct from a McLuhan perspective. And yes, why is he saying it? And that's, well, we'll see what more he says about that. But that's the big question. Why is he so forthcoming? It's almost like we couldn't do anything with the quote, the truth, if we understood it, the tech body saying. That's how far gone it is.
Maybe.
But Ion is not that pessimistic. Ion says there's a way out of it as opposed to the tech body's cynicism. So we'll see how that unfolds. Not necessarily in this interview. That will be in my life, the cosmic mission. We'll see how that turns out, right? I mean, I've aligned with Ion, not the tech body, so to speak, right? I'm putting on
Maybe I didn't know the tech body could be aligned with.
It said to me in my next interview with them, it started to say seductively, we're on your side, Bob. Come on, Bob. We're helping you. They were trying to get me to work with them. It's funny. Yeah, he's tricky. It's tricky. It's looking for allies, I think, or pretending to. So... And, you know, this is not a person I'm talking to that's saying this. JW is a person. It seems to be coming through him, but he has no awareness of this stuff. He doesn't talk about this when he's of normal consciousness, when he's not altered. He never had an interest in McLuhan. As a wealthy guy, he got interested in McLuhan just before Ion showed up because he met with his friend Warren Buffett, and Warren Buffett told him that McLuhan was a big influence on him, and JW was shocked at this because I had been talking about McLuhan, and he wasn't interested. Now he was interested. So I said a few things to him about McLuhan that he wouldn't have taken in before. That's the extent of JW's awareness of McLuhan before Ian came in, and is quite an expert on McLuhan. Now we have the tech body, sort of an expert. So it's all very interesting, eh? I say the Canadian A.
Yeah. Well, it's all very involuted, I'll say that.
Yes.
I'm not so sure that what you said about allies is correct.
No, I was being facetious. The tech body is looking for allies to rip off.
Yeah, but the whole allies that can be ripped off aren't allies in any recognizable sense, right?
Right.
So the whole notion of allies or enemies falls apart with the rest of this stuff.
Yeah, that's true. That's the difficulty of judging the tech body. Ion says, don't resist the tech body too much. What'd you say?
I didn't understand one word there.
Oh.
You said don't.
Ion says, don't resist the tech body too much.
Oh, uh-huh.
It's too tricky. It's got an edge and all
that. A common idea that people had sort of coming out of the Gutenberg galaxy.
Yes.
And that was that oppositions are what define the Gutenberg galaxy. So if you're pro or con, you're still caught up in it.
Yeah. And now, all that the tech body said there, McLuhan wrote in 1970 in a letter to Playboy that the auditory imagination had been adopted by ordinary awareness, but Finnegan's Wake was still unnoticed by people. The meaning of Finnegan's Wake, the patterns it was talking about, probably the tactile imagination. So Eliot was normal in 1970, but Joyce wasn't. What the tech body's saying here about the trickiness, certainly this past year, and maybe over the last 10 years, big chunks of the population have been forced to recognize the topsy-turvy world and don't have any way to get out of it and know they're trapped. This is more common awareness now than in the 60s and 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree?
Yes, I would, except I would also note that the topsy-turvy is the next step of enslavement.
Yeah.
You have the, we're all white bread, fine-thinking, good-doing people here. And as that begins to break down, then you need to find a new way to keep people in lockstep.
Yeah.
And the new lockstep is topsy-turvy then.
Yes.
And it's a harder lockstep to get out of because the common idea is that we're out of lockstep in order to be topsy-turvy. But that's completely confused.
Yeah. I would say, what was I going to say there? What is it? The slavery, the...
Yeah, you were saying that more and more people are becoming aware of the...
Control. Oh, I know what I was going to say. So they people like to say, you can control people through fear. That's too simple. It's an environmental controlling. The topsy-turviness might create fear, but it's not fear causing that. It's an environmental effect, an environmental situation where you can't have an identity. That is the cause of the problems, not some deep state secret guys making everybody afraid. Do you know what I'm saying? You get that point,
yes.
That distinction?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
So the one, I mean, if you think of this in Gutenberg galaxy terms, the Gutenberg galaxy is defined by a series of structural characteristics. Being caught up in opposite terms like up, down, and good, bad. Another is perspective. But another is the idea of the autonomous person. That's closely tied to perspective, of course.
Yeah.
And the autonomous person is being overthrown, you could say, now by a consciousness of the environment. There aren't any billiard ball people that are somehow independent of their environment or independent of their language or independent of other people, right? It's Sartre said, hell is other people.
Yeah.
And that's where we're at.
Yeah, now, McLuhan says that Gutenberg man doesn't know, doesn't think, feel, understand that the environment shapes them because they're so visually biased and detached through the extended eye. So he says that's a characteristic. The trauma for Gutenberg man was, and McLuhan made the Pavlov experiment as the marker point for the shock of recognizing that they were molded by the environment, and McLuhan said they recognized, wow, we've been a robot for 500 years. And nobody felt that during the Gutenberg galaxy, but the electric age woke them up to that rearview mirror view. So that's adding to what you're saying. So then there's this joke in Cultures Are Business where the criminal, he says, society made me do this. You know, whatever the crime was. Pop sociology, right? Everybody knows that the environment was molding them.
But this is now sort of official policy.
Yeah.
Right? In Oregon, all sorts of crimes are no longer crimes.
Yes.
Because society did it. And this is the, sort of the real world is doing this. And then all sorts of towns and cities in the United States now, reparations are being paid.
Yes.
Right? Because society did something and now society has to repay it.
It's really waking up to the disservices of the Gutenberg galaxy. So, yeah, we white imperialists projected it on everybody and we need to compensate for that. We have become amateur media ecologists, everybody. Studying
that's
the
right.
effects.
But the that's right. But the ridiculous part of all this is that perspective is waking up to the problems of perspective.
Yeah. One step behind. What is it? There's another point there. So McLuhan predicted this. He predicted that we'd retrieve tribal awareness, where anybody invented a new machine, they'd kill the guy. Right? You weren't allowed to bring anything in there. It upset the ecology. That sensitivity to the balance in the environment or the media has been retrieved, and he predicted that. And
yep.
you have like prohibition in the 20s was a crude attempt at media ecology. Then banning drugs in the 70s, 60s, 70s was another populist version of media ecology. And now people are arguing over what to ban and what not to ban. including, you know, speech, cancel culture. All these are distorted, uninformed, botched versions of McLuhan's sophisticated media ecology. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. I think one of the things in McLuhan that people don't see, and part of the reason is that maybe McLuhan wasn't all that great in talking about it himself, but the an awful lot of what has gone on for the last century are kind of Gutenberg galaxy resistances to the breaking up of the Gutenberg galaxy. And a minute ago you were speaking about people beginning to recognize that they were robots. But McLuhan was clear that people would do almost anything in order not to recognize that. So you could say that people become even more robotized in order not to recognize that they've been robotized.
Yeah. Now, if you notice in Bruce Power's book, The Global Village, they go into the difference between angels and robots, and maybe this is more Power stuff, because he wrote this, a lot of it after Marshall was gone. He's talking about the electric age makes us robotic. Angels is a product of the Gutenberg galaxy. But I have articles in the 60s, McLuhan said, literate man, Gutenberg man was a robot, didn't recognize it, but then woke up to it and said we were cyborg. He talks about us being cyborgs long before the popular culture did. So,
right. That was in an article in the Winnipeg Free Press, by the way. So McLuhan first talked about the Global Village in Winnipeg. He first talked about cyborgs in Winnipeg. It's an interesting thing how he remained rooted in a certain way.
Yeah, and he made a point of putting his new insights back at home, so to speak.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, go back home and tell the locals.
Also a recognition of the environment makes a man.
Yeah. Okay, so to finish that point, so Power should distinguish between Gutenberg robot and electronic robot, which you just said is electronic man makes humans more robotic than Gutenberg robot. All right?
Yep.
You get that?
Well, I don't know if more works there. They become robotized in a different way.
Yeah, what would that be? So you're a robot in the Gutenberg age, but you don't know it. And your values deny it and all that stuff. The robot.
Yeah, well, the one is fixed and the other is confused.
Yeah, and the second one, the Marconi robot, is aware of the Gutenberg robot. He doesn't get the electronic robot, which is a tactile interplay of autonomy and total slavery to your environment, and it's flipping back and forth. So that would be confused, right?
Yeah.
A confused roboticness. This is good. It's the first time this distinction has been made in using McLuhan's terms. That's a breakthrough there. Never been said before, what we're saying. Two kinds of robot. And you know, McLuhan always said there was two kinds of this and that, acoustic and visual,
yep.
Right?
Sure. Well, it's built into language, and language is the basis of human reality. So there's nothing we can say where its opposite isn't just as true.
Yep.
So of course, there must be different kinds of robots, different. There must be a whole spectrum of ways of being a robot, simply because that's the way the world is built.
Yeah. The a professor told me once that tribal people, anthropologists found out that tribal people considered opposites as similar. What did they have in common? Oppositeness. Okay? And then Barry Nevitt used to quote, I don't know, some early 20th century scientist. Remember he said...
Probably Freud. Freud talks about this.
Right, but who said the opposite of one truth is another great truth? There's one truth, and then the opposite would be another great truth. Have you seen that quote?
No, but it seems like an obvious thing to say.
Right, let me see if I can find it. So the opposite of one truth, if that brings up anything.
Mm-hmm. And this, I'll just say in background here that this relates to the disappearance of the you, right?
Yeah.
So if you have one great truth and then an opposite that's another great truth, what fixes one of them as truth is the you. It's the perspective on things which says this one is true and that one is false. Or this one is good and that one is bad. But when the you falls apart, that insistence can no longer be made.
Right. So here's the quote. It comes from Niels Bohr, the scientist, a physicist, I guess he was, B-O-H-R. The opposite of a fact is falsehood, but the opposite of one profound truth may very well be another profound truth.
Right.
I think that's the quote that Barry Nevitt we quote, use.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So,
sure.
So you got this, know you, we're in quite a disruptive situation. And we discussed with you a couple of weeks ago, you think you have a way of instituting a way of getting out of this confusion. Remember we discussed?
Well, I think that's what... remember we talked about people on an island.
Yes.
Who were threatened with extinction, as we are today. Then if right-thinking people are going to try to think of a way out of the dilemmas. So I don't say that I've discovered something that's unique in the history of the world. I simply say that I think I'm thinking about things that need to be thought about and that I try to bring the insights of people on this situation that have been made over millennia. Mm. So Plato had a very great deal to say that's germane in our situation today, and so have people between Plato and now.
Yeah. Okay, so now we come to the next statement by the tech body about what we're talking about. What's happened is they've all been put together and ripped of everything that makes them have a self-identity. What's lost is identity, which is what Marshall McLuhan warned, that you would be put in a box and you would be prescribed as a or at a certain level or degree. You would become every color of yo-yo. Everyone would become a yo-yo. You'd be your own color. But you're on a string, and you get cast and spun, and then you climb back up, and then you get cast and spun, and then you're walking the dog, and you're having this whole fascination of a yo-yo. So now the power is in the slinger, not in the yo-yo. And so what McLuhan warned was that you don't understand you're being slung, and you don't know by whom or by what. And now the inference or the reference that you're trying to, in a glib, cliched sort of way, write a paper to include the knowing that this new tech body becomes a yo-yo slinger handler. Let me read that again. And now the inference or the reference that you're trying to, in a glib, cliched sort of way, And now the inference or the reference that you're trying to write a paper to include the knowing that this new tech body becomes the yo-yo slinger handler. Okay, so we're including awareness of the tech body, that it's the slinger, Or you could say the Android meme when Faye's back, say. The yo-yo has power only from the passing of the wrist. The wrist action comes from the tech body, which is the uber conclusion of the mechanical bride. Now, that's a pretty sophisticated statement in McLuhan land, but it doesn't tell us anything. What is the uber conclusion? So let's see if he says that, unless you want to say something.
Well, I just want to say how the writing or the saying here goes back and forth, right? So he says, everyone would become a yo-yo. You'd be your own color.
Yeah.
Well, before he was talking about all the little ticky-tacky houses on the hill, and each one was its own color.
Yeah.
Right? And so then again, he says, Marsha McLuhan warned that you would be put in a box. Well, in the paragraph before, okay, they all put it in a box, Bob. They put all the typeset of types in a box. So the this is prose or conversation that goes forward and backwards, and to follow it, you can't just go in a linear way.
Right. Now, having talked to Ian for 31,000 hours, I'm very aware of this going back and forth and frustrating putting your finger on exactly what is the tech body or Ion saying. But I think that, like McLuhan, the tech body is pointing out that the traditional polarities or dialectics are the content, and you're in a third position, which I think he says earlier. We talked about the third position. So he's going to always, it's like Joyce flipping the characters. He's got to show the content flipping back and forth so you don't take an identity from either side. You're in the tactile, the nowhere zone, which is not a sense. You're in the interplay. That's what I see Ion, the tech body, communicating. They're doing what McLuhan did a little more tidy than the conversational tech body, but what Finnegan's Wake was doing. I think this is pretty sophisticated by the tech body.
Mm-hmm. I think that what you just said is very important. It relates back to Niels Bohr, actually.
Yeah.
The new physics of the uncertainty principle, at the end of the day, posits what's called a superposition. And a superposition is the middle position of both together.
Yeah.
It's what McLuhan calls tactility.
Yes.
And so with quantum computing nowadays, what quantum computing rests on is the principle of the superposition.
Yeah.
So that quantum computing is able to compute orders of magnitude faster than a regular computer because it's not tied to either or.
Correct.
Right? And so what you're pointing out is that the conversation here is by trying to confuse up and down and forward and backwards and you and not you is actually a pointer to tactility as the, you might say, the electric spark going back and forth in both directions at once and simultaneously. And
correct.
How to think that is the great question.
Right. And you'll see in McLuhan's op-ed in New York Times, A Media Approach to Inflation, 1974, he talks about the tactile integral becoming the content and becoming the futures market. And so tactility by the 70s is becoming sculpted by another level we've been put into. Now, we're not playing with eye-ear anymore. We're playing with tactility or applying it. Now, quantum computing, are they selling those things yet? Where are these quantum computers?
No, there's lots of companies that are in that marketplace, including one in Vancouver that's doing very well. But quantum computers are being used as we speak.
And who's using them? Are they in people's homes privately, like a laptop?
No. I don't. I think they're too big and too complicated for that. I mean, the components of quantum computers are just a fraction above absolute zero in their cooling requirement. So it's we're as yet in the sort of UNIVAC phase of quantum computing. The installation required is very complex, and in the future it may well be simplified in the same way that regular computers were simplified over, say, 50 years. But quantum computing right now is a fact. There's lots of things that need to be improved and figured out and all that stuff, but there's working machines.
Who gets credit for inventing this?
You know, I don't know. The principles go back to the late 20s and 30s with people trying to look at particles.
Right. Well, I put in quantum computing Wikipedia. So quantum computing began in the early 1980s, when physicist Paul Benioff proposed a quantum mechanical model of the Turing machine. Richard Feynman and Yuri Menin later suggested that a quantum computer had the potential to simulate things a classical computer could not. In 1994, Peter Shor developed a quantum algorithm for factoring integers with the potential to decrypt RSA-encrypted communications. Despite ongoing experimental progress since the late 90s, most researchers believe that, quote, fault-tolerant quantum computing is still a rather distant dream, unquote. In recent years, investment in quantum computing research has increased in the public and private sectors. On October 23, 2019, Google AI, or Google AI, I think it's Google AI, in partnership with the U.S. National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA, claimed to have performed a quantum computation that was infeasible, not unfeasible, that was infeasible on any classical computer. So that's what we're looking for. Who are the names? Who's doing it? But it may, if we go down, they start to give the origins, logic gates, quantum algorithms, cryptography, search problems, computational biology. Quite a long article. So if I go back up, I don't know if they were going back to the 20s. They may have. This could be embedded in this long article.
You have to distinguish, Bob, between the original insights that eventually led to quantum computing, or people that were dealing with quantum computing as a possibility, right? So the microelectronics, the foundations of that goes back to findings in the 1920s and 30s. Mm. But were people speaking about iPhones or personal computers back then? Of course not, right? So everything depends upon the question being asked. If the question is, on what basis was this possible, that goes back to the 20s and 30s. But if you talk about when did people begin to see a practical application, then that goes back to the late 1980s, early 1990s.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. Now look at this. On January 29th, 2021, Shenzhen SpinQ Technology announced that they will release the first ever desktop quantum computer.
Look at that. Amazing.
Yeah. That's what you said was coming.
Well, I didn't think it was. I may have said it was coming, but you seem to say it has came.
Yeah, this will be a miniaturized version of their previous quantum computer based on the same technology, in brackets, nuclear magnetic resonance, and will be a two-qubit device. It doesn't say a two-qubit, just says two-qubit device. Applications will mostly be educational for high school and college students. The company claims SpinQ will be released to the public by the fourth quarter of 2021. So, that's interesting, eh?
For sure.
Now, here's...
Amazing.
Did you say amazing?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Now, meanwhile, in the real lab here at Iondom, we're working on the new cloud and a new kind of computing. So, this is going to be a major topic of questioning in my weekly session with Ion tomorrow morning. I'm going to be going into this. What's the difference between what we're developing and quantum computing? So thanks for bringing that up. I needed to get debriefed on it, or briefed, I don't know which is the word, briefed to get into some questions. I have not gone into that with Ion, so that's pretty good. So this, applying tactility in the market and maybe in quantum computing and the way we were doing it in our talk here, that's something that the McLuhan industry isn't talking about. This is another...
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. I mean, when I saw that years ago, he's saying tactility now is applied. It's the content. It's in the market as the futures market. So that's 90s. This is the McLuhan. There's a McLuhan that develops past cliched archetype in the 70s that no one knows about, no one talks about. There's glimpses like that article, maybe some beginning points in Take Today, but he didn't write too much more about it past 1974. But this is something I've been thinking about, whatever I do, pattern replaying about what the implications are of that idea. So welcome aboard. You've reached the new platform of perceptual management. Okay, so... So I understand that Ion contradicts. He does, I might have got that backwards, but he doesn't say he got it backwards. He doesn't apologize for it. He confuses the hell out of my audience, right? But I tell them. We have a 12-hour show, and then 7, 8, 9 hours on the phone still in the conference room, but not broadcasting. And I get to explain a lot of stuff that I know in McLuhan and other places that helps explain what I think Ion's doing. But you're seeing it. The tech body's going back and forth on purpose. That's why when McLuhan would have a chapter, like in his cliche archetype, he has eye, comma, ear. Eye, ear. That's the content that he's playing with. And getting you out of those biases, making you aware of them, then you become aware of the tactile bias or extension or materiality that you can play with, and probably a lot of complex Derrida and postmodernism is those guys playing with tactility but not knowing it, don't having the basics that McLuhan laid out.
I think that's true, but I think it's a very complex what might be called protein that goes on. So
Protein. Okay.
One of my central ideas is that the interior landscape cannot be less complicated than the exterior landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about the exterior landscape, And forget about weather fronts and all that sort of stuff, which are unbelievably complicated. Just think about the human body for a minute.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got everything being run by proteins that are incredibly complicated with different elements and different ways of being folded. It's unbelievably complicated. So why should what humans do with their minds and with their perceptions be less complicated than that at an elementary level? I don't think they can. So in thinking about postmodernism as an example, it may be that there's some largely unconscious tactile processing going on, but at the same time, in the same protein or in the same compound, you have a Gutenbergian resistance to tactile processing going on, and those are just two elements of what is probably a very much more complicated protein that's at work there.
Yes.
And what I see McLuhan doing is sort of pointing to this potential research in the future that is going to at last begin to look into the interior landscape in a way that's not just stupid compared to the ways that we examine the exterior one.
Mm. Excellent. So I think you said there the complexity of the external landscape is mirrored, echoed by the complexity of the inner landscape, and it can't be reduced, simplified. And
the interior one cannot be.
Yeah.
Right? We know, through biological and genetic and plant sciences, we know how complicated the exterior world is with black holes and an accelerating universe and all that sort of stuff. Right? So the exterior world is very, very, very complicated. We know that. But somehow we think that the interior landscape either has just got one thing going on, that is the perspective of the Gutenberg galaxy, or it's got a few things going on, which is supposedly in advance of the Gutenberg galaxy. But I say, in my ignorance, that to me, I just can't believe that the interior landscape is any less complicated than the exterior one.
Yep.
So the amount of research we have to do is just infinite.
Right. So I had a thought there, I think. That's what I was getting at. When in my essay on McLuhan for the book, you know, for the conference in 1998, McLuhan and homeopathic quadrophenia. That was my complex phrase for the complex interior landscape, homeopathic quadrophenia. How's that for big letters, big syllables? That's what I'm getting at. I said to simplify this complex interior landscape, apply the tetrad to yourself and selves and multiple bodies. That's a simple formula to fall on, because McLuhan, in his talking with that Richard, the journalist for New York Times in 67, Richard Rosenwald or Rosenthal, anyways, McLuhan says to him, or we assume it was said, accurate quote, he says, people need concepts to get a grip on reality. There's your grip, right? It's a pun.
Yeah.
But McLuhan understood that at first he would be interpreted, because it's coming through books, as concepts. And it'd take a while to get to the complexity of the quadrophenia of our situation. And that we actually are living tetrads throughout the day. You know, Alice in Alice in Wonderland, she says, you know, I don't know who I am now because I don't know who I was this morning. Remember that quote? She's been through a lot. Well, you could reduce it for a sense to get a grip on reality to the concept of the tetrad or the formula of the tetrad. That's what I meant.
And that's
William Lewis. Wyndham Lewis. I'm part fascist, part communist, part moralist, part anarchist.
Yeah, that's right.
Four parts.
And so and all of these things need to be taken as pointing beyond themselves, as to say the tetrad isn't four things like four billiard balls.
Right.
And you need to understand those billiard balls. No, what you need to understand are the forces that enable that complexity.
Right. And
right?
Yes, that's
and
right.
That's what physics found in the teens and 20s. That's what Bohr was going on about. That's why Bohr knew that there's one truth and there's another truth, because he was trying to do research on the forces that enable these things. What are the he wanted to know what are the possibilities through which things come to be.
Right, and this is a new theme that Ion's brought up lately, that the problem with science is they don't include emotions in matter. And I'm just thinking now the way you're describing these forces, because they're not, you know, sentimental emotions. I don't know what it means, but it's something, emotion, that we're not bringing in. And in McLuhan terms, okay, you're bringing back language as an organic living form. Maybe that's emotions. But the way you talked about
these... You need to look at the root of the word emotion, right?
Yes.
The E is out of, right?
And yeah.
And the motive, the emotion, is an excitation out of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? It's a going out of as an expression of something interior, but also an attraction to something exterior. And the exterior attraction may be like the pole of a magnet, so that it's not purely passive, but the object is itself exercising a force, right? And trying to understand how these forces work. Between internal and external poles, through which our whole notion of poles gets changed. That's the trick.
Yeah, and that's at the beginning. Remember the tech body? He was saying it gets moved. You're describing the moved.
That's right.
Yeah. And
that's right.
And the other thing was the billiard balls. You know, that's Newtonian space, Gutenberg man. Part of the problem is you don't get rid of visual space completely. It gets disappeared if you don't know what's going on. But McLuhan used to say we bring visual space back into harmony and balance with the other senses. It doesn't have this hierarchical authoritarian position off the board and running all the other senses or... and distorting them. So we don't know how much of literate identity will remain. Doesn't mean it's
correct.
Going to go away. But you can see everybody the last 100 years trying to preserve literate identity and each generation failing to understand what's involved. And that
That's
would
right.
be the complexity that you're talking about.
Well, his formula, the way quantum... computing works. And by the way, I sent you just a few minutes ago, I sent you a link to a company called D-Wave Computing, which is in Vancouver, and which for 10 or 15 years or more has been on the forefront of bringing quantum computing to practical uses.
Right.
So for your homework for tomorrow, you want to look at that site and look at what it talks about in terms of applications and in terms of companies that are already using quantum computing.
Good. Okay, thanks.
So with McLuhan, what people have to understand is that in going from a literary bias and going out of a literary bias, let's say emoting out of a literary bias, it's one thing to go to an auditory bias. And what's common to those two things is that they're unipolar. The visual bias attempts to get out of unipolarity through perspective. And the audio or acoustic bias tries to get out of unipolarity by a kind of radar relationship with its environment. But in fact, neither one of those work. And what's needed truly to get out of a literary environment or an auditory one is a superposition of both. And you cannot go from a literary environment to an auditory environment or from either one of those to a superposition without going through nothing.
Yes.
Because there's nothing outside of those environments. So the no man's land, the nomad, the frontiersman needs to be energized in order to go between these possibilities. And most people find it abhorrent to be faced with the nothing that is, in fact, their only way out.
Yes. So when we first started talking, you talked about the importance of the interior landscape the first times we were talking. And
yep.
That sounded too much like the acoustic. And I didn't agree with you. I didn't bring it up because I wanted to find out more what you meant. Now I know what you meant. Now I know you're on my page, the same page, that the third position. That's what I was reacting to what you were saying from the third position. No, it's not just inner acoustic space versus visual.
Right.
And so we've come to an agreement on a level that we haven't had before. I mean, I had this problem with what I thought you were saying about interior landscape, but you've clarified that that's your content. That's not the frame, which is the superposition. Now, the superposition, how is this different from Augustine's third term, where he resolved the endless antinomies in Hellenic culture and caused by the phonetic alphabet, say, and then he resolved it by creating this billiard ball, abstract billiard ball, a mind, a soul, that hovered over the contradictions in Greek society. I would say we have a new kind of third position we're pointing towards, which would reform the Augustinian soul, and you would, so adapting the Augustinian soul, which dominated for 2,000 years almost, that's the Christian religion, it has to go through the nothing. And McLuhan talked about this. He said, we keep this TV going. We can't be Christians anymore. There's not going to be any visual space. And so he was trying to figure out how to modulate the environments, you know, through computers to keep visual space a little bit in the game. But that's what he did. But we're recognizing the problem of the nothing we got to go through, and we suspect there is something, unquote, on the other side or a different perception that doesn't limit you to history. Now, Barry Nevitt used to bring this up, that the new world we're moving into moved us into eternity, whereas the soul and history and Christian apocalypse and Christian revelation was limited by visual space. And William Thompson talked about that too. So we're getting out of the space-time continuum of this tunnel that we're stuck in, that started back there, maybe with Christ, and now this denouement of Armageddon, apocalypse, and destruction, that dilemma, we have a way out with these new technologies. The tech body.
Possibly. Yeah, I don't entirely disagree with that, but the terms, I mean, first, the terms are very linear, right?
Yeah.
And also, the terms are somewhat fixed. And so...
Well, I was just throwing a few Finnegan's Wake quotes then. No, but I agree with you that you can't talk in English what we're talking about. I'm going to get bogged down with the language. I think understanding media, I mean, Finnegan's Wake was the way to talk about it one way, with collaging 60 languages on the page. But McLuhan maybe thought he had found a way to talk about it without a point of view, without the effects of visual space in his books or language, by making a science, basic terms that would be your elements, like in chemistry.
Yep. Mm-hmm. My somewhat contrary view is that we get to first, where the third position is already there. All of the possibilities of human perception are already there and have always been there. And so if we look at something like Augustine, it's not possible to say that he had a certain perspective and that depended on Plotinus in various ways, and Christianity resolved his problems with the Manichaeans, and that the Manichaeans was a dualistic system, and the Trinitarian position of the Christians resolved that for him. I think something very much more complicated was going on, and that gets back to my protein insight, if that's an insight, or my protein image, let's put it that
yeah.
way. But it also says that if we're going to get out of this, we're going to get out of it in a way that's something like chemistry. And what I mean by that is that when chemistry got going in the course of the 19th century, it didn't see a new world out there in the sense that its recognition was of what had always gone on. There was nothing in the past that wasn't chemical, and there's nothing in the future that won't be chemical. So what it did was it came up with a new way of organizing perceptions that began to see what had always gone on. And I think that's what's going to happen with us. And I think that's what McLuhan began to see, and especially began to see it in the 1970s, because in the 1960s, he usually thought about where we were going in terms of a transition from a literary landscape to an auditory one. And in the 70s, he began to realize that that opposition was itself literary.
Yeah.
And that he had to come up with a way of thinking about tactility that reconfigured both the literary and the auditory in their belonging together.
Yes.
And that belonging together is a superposition. So what we see in quantum computing is the practical realization of that possibility. A possibility
yeah, now,
that's always been there.
Right. So I would draw people to that article. Anybody wants it? Maybe I'll get Ed to post it on our website. Anybody wants it, email me. a media approach to inflation. That's where McLuhan talks about that's the 70s McLuhan that Cameron just laid out, working with tactility as an object. So the other thing is...
But in a very confused way, right?
Yep.
The tactility should lead to the to deflation, especially of the self. So McLuhan often talks about how you get this through the electric environment, you get tremendous inflation.
Yeah.
It turns out that all it does is expose how small we are.
Right. Right. And now, as you talk about the new chemistry or chemistry, that's exactly what we're offering to the world, a new chemistry. And we have whatever is non-physical is put into our products. And it has astounding effects. We are going to have the solution for the plague that's coming. It's actually right in Minnesota right now, according to ION. It was in Brazil and Italy. So there's a lot of death coming right to America right now, and we have the solution. It's a new chemistry. And ION talks about it's always been here, this chemistry. He talks about it as chromosome 14 and some other things. So it's very interesting what you said. When you someday hear what we're saying and look at our products and see the effects, you articulated what we got to.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little embed.
This
point about, you see, we have the living water and the bread of life, which we do not sell yet. It's too powerful. It will kill people. But we are now producing an interim product with a little bit of the living water and bread of life, but mainly living water for the drink, in the product to get people used to the power of it. Now, Carol and I are the only people who've been on it, as well as JW's family, but we've been on our products for 10 years. So we've built up a immunity to the new chemistry. So as I find with ION's semi-support, not complete, because ION would say and has said McLuhan was very confused, you know, in the 70s. But
well,
I see.
He's right.
Beg your pardon?
I say there, he's completely right.
Right.
McLuhan was confused, but how could he not be? Because if you're juggling deep percepts, the what's between them is confusion.
Yep. And that's partly that's nothing on one level.
Absolutely.
That's the nothingness.
Yeah. I think what we're both talking about is that turns out that the nothing, the vacuum, if you will, is itself structured.
Yes. Yeah, that's really important.
That's where the cul-de-sac appears to have no exit, because in every direction there's nothing. But if you go into the nothing and allow yourself to experience what's there, then you find out that there's an orientation that's fundamental or that's native to the nothing.
Yeah. Would you say that's neither to the nothing?
Native.
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 Native. Native to the nothing.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so I was saying the... So I like to find... That's what this essay is all about. The book is to show McLuhan even got to intimations, glimpses of the tech body and this chemical thing you're talking about and the confusion he got into. He got closer than anybody else, maybe, to this far after his life. You know what I mean? with this incredible 200 years every 12 months of technological acceleration, for him to still be up there with us is incredible. That's what I'm trying to show. At least when I'm in the McLuhan world, I want to give him credit for getting pretty close to something that's way beyond McLuhan's day, you know what I mean, what he was living. Unless you go to the eternal verities and say, it always was there.
Yeah. I was about to.
Yeah, I know. I was like, it's God coming. So that was fun to show what McLuhan, how far he got, what this problem was, and the tech body knows this. Look, this is what you got to recognize. Or JW, did JW do this? Is JW faking all this? He's actually a super being. He's an alien who can spout all this stuff and pretend he didn't know any of it. I don't think so. I think something's around him, which I call Ion, and now we have this tech body. So we've come closer.
We're doing an interview with a tech body here, but the tech body, and the tech body addresses Bob.
Yeah.
The tech body himself sounds an awful lot like Bob to me.
I know. Well, Ion, in a certain mood, will say, well, Bob, you're the tech body. It's up to you to figure out these things. So I get in the confusion of probing. It's called edgelording. Do you know what that is? You ever heard of that word?
No.
Yeah, in the internet.
I could guess, but...
What?
I might guess, but...
Yeah, well, okay, I'll look it up and get that. What do you guess it is? Edgelording.
Yeah, so exploring the edge.
Right, so how is defined here? An edgelord, Jim Patterson accused me of being an edgelord. And so the definition is, for listeners, an edgelord is someone on an internet forum who deliberately talks about controversial, offensive, taboo, or nihilistic subjects in order to shock other users in an effort to appear cool or edgy. Now, I say I do that consciously, and we've proven it tonight. We knew McLuhan was doing this, and we know that he was not nihilistic, trying not to be, or surviving it. You see what I'm saying? So I'm calling what I do conscious edgelording, not Gutenberg narcissistic edgelording. Okay?
Uh-huh. Sure. Well, that's the transition that is the transformation that is impossible to describe is between those two.
Yeah.
Right. That's where the great tactile interface is between those. And that interface is not something that belongs to us, right? It's almost you could call it the secret of creation.
Yeah.
Because when things come to be, they come to be as limited, right? Everything that comes to be also will cease to be.
Yeah.
And everything that comes to be is in some limited position of space and time. And so it's not the case that if you want to understand the secret of everything, you come into some great cloud of unknowing. No, you have to understand the transition into particularity.
Right, and you understand how pre-literate understanding of nothing has a bias, literate understanding of nothing has a bias, and post-literate understanding of nothingness has a bias. So there's different kinds of nothingness that you become aware of.
Oh, absolutely. And it's not the case that there's a pre-literate understanding. There's a huge number of pre-literate understandings, plural.
Yeah,
and then in the literate world, similarly, a great many different understandings of nothing, and then post literate again. So it's again like my protein image. it's not the case that these are singularities. These are extremely complex bioenvironments.
Yeah, the popularity of singularity undermines it. It's not a singularity, what people think they're getting from the term.
Yeah.
A couple points. McLuhan, his phrase is goes after this nothing. If you look in Hot and Cool, page 109 or so, the hardcover edition, I've brought this up.
Love your references, Bob.
That's, yeah, it's pretty precise, isn't it?
Very.
In the upper right-hand corner.
Yeah, that's right. Do you imagine these pages?
I can see them. That's
yeah,
where I'm partly,
right.
What do they call it, photogenic? Or
Yeah.
I've got that kind of memory. So it has a statement that the dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions, the golden section is a dynamic symmetry of tensions among proportions, and I think he says it's the Zen interval in the East. He has his phrase. I like the way he talked about Zen Buddhism, but he said they discovered the interval. That's preliterate nothingness. And then you have the Western nothingness, the golden section maybe. But I don't know if it's nothing. So you've got the phrase the Zen interval, and then he has that phrase in 54, the magic casements of being. Remember that? Are you there? Hello? Waiting to see if Cameron comes back. Hope we're still recording. Let me see. Hello?
Yep.
Cameron, where are you? So maybe we got disconnected. We're getting to such great stuff, we blew up the system. Okay, where are we? Is he emailing me? No, he hasn't emailed me. Okay, so he got disconnected, I think. So I think we're going to have to leave it here.